Well, so good afternoon, and you've been reading the title for a few seconds here, but basically today I'd like to tell you about some of our recent results using a single electron transistor to look at the coherence of charge states in the single Cooper pair box. So this system we're working with is very similar to the one you heard about this morning from Nakamura and so on. The data I'll show is the work of a very talented postdoc in my group at Yale, Conrad Lehnert, who is actually a sort of local boy, a product from Jim Allen's group here at Santa Barbara. I'd also like to acknowledge many interesting and very informative discussions with Michelle Devere and Steve Gervin, both of whom will be joining the faculty at Yale starting this year. And finally, one of Per Delsing's students at Chalmers University fabricated the sample. All the measurements were done at Yale. So this is the overview of what I'd like to tell you about. First of all, I have to do a little bit of a review about the Cooper pair box. And in particular, I'll show you what the energy spectrum for that system looks like in a variety of different cases, so you have a way to sort of interpret the data that we're going to show you later on. And then there are essentially two kinds of measurements that we're able to do with this apparatus in the same setup. The first is where we use the SET as an electrometer to measure the states in the Cooper pair box. We can do some CW spectroscopy and determine an ensemble average decoherence time. And the second experiment, we sort of turn things around a little bit. We use the Cooper pair box as a type of spectrum analyzer to actually look at the back action of the measurement setup, to look at the back action of the SET electrometer. And there we begin to do time-gated measurements and to look at the charge state mixing and find the inelastic relaxation time of the Cooper pair box. I think that's the first measurement of a T1 for the Cooper pair box. And in the unlikely event that I get through all the transparencies and there's still time remaining, I'll talk about the future prospects. So, you heard about this a little bit this morning. I like to just try and remind people that although this business all falls under the rubric of quantum computation, and there's a goal of doing information processing some point far out in the future, there's this daunting list of requirements. You can view that as a really, daunting technical challenge, but you can also realize that they're really interesting fundamental physics problems that you have to understand and master in order to do these requirements and to really get to the point of information processing. In particular, some of the things that we're really interested in are these questions of how do you measure these individual artificial quantum systems? What are the effects of quantum measurement? What kinds of things can you see? And also, of course, all these systems, there's a real big problem about getting long enough coherence. The decoherence times are very, very short in general, and this is one of the biggest challenges with any kind of solid state qubit. As I'll point out, this is sort of nice. It basically amounts to doing very, very demanding noise experiments in these mesoscopic systems and getting in and looking at the sort of high-speed dynamics of the mesoscopic systems. And if you could do these first four, then the real fun begins when you get into complex entanglements. So this is my little cartoon of the Cooper pair box. Basically, you have a superconducting island, which is coupled to a reservoir via a small capacitance Josephson junction. There's a second lead, which is just capacitively coupled, no tunneling, to this island. And it's a voltage on that lead, which you control. That's the parameter, which is accessible at room temperature and allows you to manipulate terms in the Hamiltonian and control the quantum states of the system. And of course, if this island were really just isolated, it would have a fixed number of charges on it. The Cooper pair number n on that island would be a good quantum number. And this n is going to be the degree of freedom that we use in realizing our artificial two-level system, our qubit. And again, this gate voltage parameter is the important thing that we can control. So of course, there's an electrostatic part of the Hamiltonian. The n states are eigenstates of that. And the first important energy scale in this problem is the charging energy, which for typical things that we can make is on the order of a Kelvin or so. Okay. And I'll go through, hopefully kind of quickly, because this is a sophisticated audience, several different plots for different cases that look like this, okay? And all the data I'll show will be sort of like this bottom curve, all right? So what's plotted here is everything as a function of this control parameter in terms of basically a gate charge, C gate, V gate, the charge you add through the gate capacitor to the island of the transistor, normalized in units of a Cooper pairs charge. And up top is the energy levels for different numbers of Cooper pairs on the island. And at the bottom is what you would measure if you could actually measure the number of Cooper pairs on the island. That's what we're going to measure with our electrometer. And so you see the familiar sort of parabole, which you get from Coulomb blockade physics. If you could measure the number, basically it's going to change wherever these charge states are degenerate. And you get a staircase here, a so-called Cooper pair staircase, where the number of Cooper pairs on the box changes discretely at these degeneracy points where the charge states would intersect. And the spacing of the stairs is 2e in terms of gate charge. The height of the stairs is 2e in terms of charge, or 1 in terms of Cooper pair number added to the box. Now, the way in which we actually couple together the charge states, the way in which you introduce the possibility of changing the Cooper pair number, is via this Josephson tunneling element. So there's a term in the Hamiltonian due to that. And this Hamiltonian, of course, couples the charge states together. And the Josephson energy is just determined by the superconducting gap and the resistance of the junction. And what you get here in this case is you move from these sort of dotted parabolas, which you had in the presence of only the electrostatic piece, to this kind of picture here where you have an avoided crossing. And at this point, if we work in the charge regime, which is where we're operating, so that the charging energy is much larger than the Josephson energy, you basically couple together via the Josephson term just two different charge states. And in this regime of gate charge, or voltage on the gate, you have this two-level system. If you go over here, you have another two-level system, presumably pretty much the same. And again, in this case, you would see something which is a 2e periodic Cooper pair staircase. The main difference here is that now these transitions, instead of being just thermally broadened, are broadened due to the lifting of this degeneracy by the Josephson coupling. So you get a smearing which is due to the size of the Josephson coupling energy. Now, that's a nice simple picture. However, that's simplifying things a little bit. I'm pretending that there are only Cooper pairs in the system, but in principle, we could have some quasi-particles around if the system weren't necessarily freezing all those degrees of freedom out. So if I include the possibility of having quasi-particles, we would get an extra set of parabolae, an extra family of curves, shown here as the dotted lines, where we would have, let's say, one additional quasi-particle on the island of the box. Those states, as I've drawn them here, are shifted up in energy by an amount delta Twiddle, the even-odd free energy difference. And at low temperatures, this should be basically equal to the superconducting gap in the island of the transistor. And so if we can arrange to have this situation, then those quasi-particle degrees of freedom are energetically too costly. They're frozen out of the picture. However, that even-odd free energy difference doesn't have to always be the superconducting gap. In particular, these odd parity states have very high degeneracy. There's a lot of single particle states available for the quasi-particle. And so you find that there's an entropic correction to the free energy difference, basically just due to that that high degeneracy of the states. And in particular, as one raises the temperature, this even odd free energy difference decreases. But if you can arrange this situation where you have the even odd free energy energy difference larger than the charging energy, we maintain the nice 2e periodic Cooper pair staircase. So this free energy difference depends on temperature. If you raise the temperature, and this physics is actually fairly well understood from studies of superconducting transistors, for example, there's a crossover temperature T star, which for the typical sizes of aluminum devices that can be made is in the range of 250 to 300 millikelvin, where this free energy difference goes to zero. So it's not actually the transition temperature of the superconductor, it's this somewhat lower energy scale. In the case that this free energy difference goes to zero, obviously the dotted parabolas move down. You find a 1e periodic staircase, and it's sort of like the Cooper pair box is in the normal state. So now these steps are half as wide and half as tall. And we're adding, at these various points here, the intersections of the dotted and the solid lines, electrons one at a time to the Cooper pair box. Fine. The final case that I want to do, I'm boring you all a little bit with this energy spectrum, but I think it's good to have these pictures in the back of your head when we're looking at the data. If we had sort of an intermediate case where the free energy difference lies somewhere greater than zero but less than the charging energy, the parabolas are pushed up but not above the crossing points, we get in this case a 2e periodic staircase. The pattern repeats only every 2e worth of gate charge. But instead of having the desired single transition with a height of 2e, we have two transitions where we add a quasi-particle and then remove it, going to an even parity state. So these are odd parity states, even parity states. And this behavior is sort of known in the field as long step, short step. So in any case, nonetheless, if we satisfy the conditions shown here in this red box, which you can do for the technology we work with, you can obtain the following sort of picture for the full spectrum. You have, again, because the Josephson energy is small compared to the charging energy, a coupling at these degeneracy points of two different charge states for the Cooper pair box. The quasiparticles are basically at a high enough energy, they're frozen out of the problem. We have this 2E periodic Cooper pair staircase. And OK, this is the case we desire in order to make a charge-based qubit or a two-level system. So I'm claiming it's a two-level system. So since all two-level systems are alike, we can map this onto a spin a half particle in a magnetic field. You can introduce a sort of block sphere picture, and we can talk about these superpositions of charge states, which are the eigenstates of the system, as being some orientation of a sort of pseudo-spin vector on a block sphere. There are two important fields due to the Josephson term in the Hamiltonian and the electrostatic term in the Hamiltonian. What's really important, though, is that, of course, now we should introduce the concepts and the language of, say, NMR. And we should talk about the important things being the Larmor frequency, the Rabi frequency, and these timescales, T2 and T1, for the decoherence and the inelastic lifetime of the states of this system. And I just want to emphasize that the thing you control, once again, with your gate voltage is this field in what I'm calling here the z direction. The thing we're going to measure is this number n of Cooper pairs that are present on the box. And that n in the block sphere picture corresponds essentially to just making a projection of your state vector along this z direction, the direction the electrostatic part is in the direction of. So if we can measure charge, we basically project this in the z direction. OK. So this is, again, exactly the same two-level system that you heard about from Yasunobu Nakamura this morning, where he's done, in fact, these really beautiful experiments where he's directly observed the Rabi oscillations of the two-level system. He's obtained measurements of the decoherence time in various different cases. And essentially, we're working with exactly the same system. What's different is the way in which we measure. And I won't go into how he does his measurement. You heard about that this morning. But here's the system that we use. So basically, here's the circuit diagram. We have the Cooper pair box drawn in blue, and then the measurement apparatus drawn in red. It's just a single electron transistor, two junctions in series. We're going to apply a bias voltage to the drain source, and some current can flow. That current's a sensitive function of the potential felt by, or the potential of, the island in the center of the single electron transistor. So it makes a very sensitive electrometer. And the way in which we're going to couple the Cooper pair box to the measurement system is just capacitively. Here's a micrograph of one of these systems. There's the Cooper pair box, a control lead for the box, a control gate for the electrometer. And here's the two junctions in series of the electrometer, drain and source lead going this way. Since they're in proximity, there's this measurement capacitance, Cm, that couples them together. So if we add a charge to the Cooper pair box, that's going to change the potential of the single electron transistor, or basically couple some fraction of that charge through the measurement capacitor over to the electrometer, and we can measure that. And again, this is all fabricated for us by the guys at Sweden currently. This is done with the sort of standard double angle evaporation, aluminum junctions. Transition temperature is about 1.5 Kelvin. The gap is about 2.5 Kelvin. OK, so this is basically our system. Now, there's one detail here about the electrometer. The electrometer we use is this variant called the RF-SET, or radio frequency single electron transistor, which we developed in our lab. It's basically just a technical trick. Instead of applying a voltage and measuring a current, what we do is apply some RF power to the drain source lead of the transistor using a transformer, try and match it to 50 ohms. And we measure the amount of RF power which was reflected from the transistor. And basically, that RF reflection is just simply related to the conductance of the SET, and therefore to the potential or to the gate charge that you couple to the single electron transistor. So it's really a very simple trick. The nice thing about it is it gives us much improved sensitivity. We've got charge noise for these electrometers in the few to 10 microelectrons per root hertz range. And we also can get open loop bandwidths up to hundreds of megahertz for this kind of system. Basically, you're only limited here not by some RC times, but by how fast this resonant circuit can ring up. And here's a measurement showing a single shot in the time domain for a classical signal, a voltage step applied to the gate of one of these RF-SETs, which induces 0.2 electrons of charge on the electrometer. And the red is a single shot in the time domain. So basically, the point here is that you can actually begin to resolve now sort of sub-electron or single-electron charges on microsecond or sub-microsecond timescales, which is going to be really nice for looking at the charge states on the box, given sort of the, how fast all the timescales that are involved are. We take this system, put it all together, put it in the dilution refrigerator, and cool it down. And we'll start with a very simple case, which I introduced to you before. That's the high temperature case where we're above this crossover temperature, T star, for the Cooper pair box. So in this case, there's, on average, at least one thermally excited quasiparticle on the island of the Cooper pair box. These dashed parabolas are shifted down in energy, and we expect to see, and in fact we do see, something which is just a 1E periodic staircase. We have uniformly spaced steps in both the X and the Y direction. And as we increase the temperature above this crossover temperature, the only thing that happens is you get more and more thermal broadening of this Coulomb staircase. One thing this allows us to do, if you look here at the blue data, 300 millikelvin, there's actually a fit drawn in there using three adjustable parameters, and that lets us extract three of the important capacitances we need to know for our system. There's an unknown X scale, which is how we determine the gate capacitance, because we know that this staircase at high temperatures is periodic in one electron on the gate. There's a scaling in the Y direction, which basically tells us how large a change in potential we find on the electrometer for a one electron change of the charge state of the Cooper pair box. So that lets us determine the measurement capacitance, the coupling capacitance. And finally, there's another capacitance or an energy scale, which is related through the temperature to the strength of the broadening that you see here in these transitions. So that's basically a way to find the charging energy, EC, of the box. And this is about 0.9 Kelvin. And if we continue to increase the temperature, these other solid black curves here are basically just theory curves with no adjustable parameters. So the Coulomb staircase you observe agrees quite nicely with sort of simple theory in this simple case. And maybe it's obvious, maybe it's not. The signal to noise is really quite nice. You can actually see these charging steps in sort of real time on the oscilloscope, which is really invaluable when you're trying to debug, for example, glitches in your spectrum. So continuing on. Now, the interesting thing should happen as we cool below this crossover temperature and we get rid of the quasiparticle states. And again, what you expect to happen as we reduce the temperature, this even odd free energy difference should grow. And the charging energy, remember, we just determined was about a Kelvin. The BCS value of the gap for our aluminum would be something like 2.5 Kelvin. So we'd expect the dotted curves, the odd states, to move up above and be out of the picture. What you see here in the data as you begin to cool, between 300 and 200 millikelvin, the pattern changes, and it becomes something which is 2E periodic, but it looks a little bit like this long step, short step pattern that I described for you before. In other words, you have to go a complete Cooper pair's worth of gate charge to have things repeat, but you have a longer step and a shorter step. So now this is sort of qualitatively what you could have if you had defective superconductors, okay? For example, here's a fit in black to the 20 millikelvin data using just this sort of picture of the charging, including the odd parity states. And from that, you can extract a value of this even odd free energy difference, which is only about 60 millikelvin compared to the value we'd expect at 20 millikelvin of about 2.5 Kelvin. Furthermore, what we see in the temperature dependence is not really consistent with this parity effect with the quasiparticle states. For example, even if the even odd free energy difference were this low because of some defect, state in the gap or something like that, you'd at least expect, as you raise the temperature, remember, the even odd free energy difference should get smaller. And what we find in order to fit our data is this free energy difference would have to grow first and then go back to zero. So I don't know really any way that we can do that with just superconductivity. And what I'll tell you about in the second half of the talk, if I can get there, is how this is probably just understandable from some two-level physics combined with the way in which we're making the measurement. Okay. So nonetheless, we can plow ahead, and we can do not NMR spectroscopy, but CPR spectroscopy. Okay, we apply, in addition to this DC gate voltage, an AC wiggle on the gate. That is, we apply some photons to the system from a monochromatic source. Therefore, we expect that there should be two points on either side of the degeneracy where the energy splitting between the ground and excited state is resonant with the frequency of this drive. And we can drive transitions between the ground and excited state. And basically, what we expect to see and what we do see are these narrow peaks, which point in two different directions here, because basically what you do is you take something which is in a state zero, and you start including some population of state one when you drive the transitions. And there are two different frequencies shown on here. So now over some limited range in frequencies, we can plot the position of these peaks. And what that allows us to do, first of all, is to make another independent measurement of the charging energy for our system. And we find that it's somewhere in this range, which is consistent with the value we got from the thermal behavior at high temperatures. What we aren't able to do is apply photons down in this more interesting region where you have the avoided crossing toward the degeneracy point. And basically, the reason for that is the maximum effect you can get from the photons here is to take something that was in the ground state and drive it to equal populations in excited and ground state, which would mean you'd have not a charge of zero or one, but a charge of a half. And you see the system's already in that state with charge a half for some reason, which I'll come to. So there's no effect for the low-frequency photons. But in any case, we can still do quantitative spectroscopy in the range where we see the photon peaks. What I'm showing here is just the difference in the staircase with and without the microwave photons applied. And increasing the power going down, you see there are peaks which are fixed in position, but whose height and width both grow. And that's exactly what you expect from your sort of driven two-level system. There should be plotted as a function of the microwave power, or the square of the Rabi frequency for this two-state system, an increase in the peak height to a maximum of a half in terms of Cooper pair number. And furthermore, if you plot here the line width squared against the Rabi frequency squared, you find a linear dependence. And by extrapolating this linear dependence back to zero power, you find a y-intercept, which is basically 1 over the decoherence time squared. And so this allows us to determine, in this case, a T2 of about 1 nanosecond. And this is quite consistent with what Yasu has measured, and under fairly similar conditions. So we're far away from the degeneracy point where we're maximally sensitive to offset charge fluctuations. We're also in the presence of a continuous measurement, which could be introducing extra dephasing. Furthermore, these curves take about 20 minutes to accumulate. And in many cases at low power, you will see clear evidence of inhomogeneous broadening. There's a little forest of narrow peaks, which then merge together with longer averaging. So yes. Is that right? Do I have it? Yeah, that's right. In Hertz, for example. Yeah. What do you mean, normal part? Yes. No, we don't have this tunneling probe, but what we are doing is we're measuring capacitively what the charge state is. So. Yes, that's right. We don't yet know enough of the parameters precisely enough to calculate, for example, a dephasing rate due to our measurement. My zeroth guess is that it's on this order of magnitude, but a little bit bigger. So it's not clear what the mechanism of the dephasing is. Let's get to that in the end, and we'll talk about that in the questions, I hope. So now there's still this mystery lurking there, which is why can't we see things toward the degeneracy point? So that's what I want to talk about in this last portion of the talk. And actually, we're doing okay. So the question you want to ask yourself here is, who's measuring whom? And as you saw from the spectroscopy, you know that basically the Cooper pair box, that any two-level system, can operate as a spectrum analyzer. Okay, when the energy difference of the two-state system is resonant with some drive, it can absorb energy, and you depolarize your system. Okay, it's a spectrum analyzer with really lousy dynamic range, for those of you experimentalists out there, because essentially if we start introducing transitions which go both up and down between the excited and the ground state, as soon as the rate of those transitions exceeds the intrinsic relaxation rate of the two-state system, you're going to saturate to something which is just equal weights in the two states. And what this spectrum looks like, what could be causing this spectrum here, again, the solid curve is the sort of 2E periodic staircase that you expect to observe. But in this continuous measurement, we see this plateau here, which now I'm going to call the saturation region. Basically, it looks as though we have some photons applied to the Cooper pair box, some broadband spectrum of low-frequency photons. And where are those coming from? Well, they're coming from the fact that we have this continuous measurement. They're coming from the back action of the single electron transistor. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about that process. So first of all, I have to tell you a thing or two about the electrometer. It's this transistor which has two control parameters, the drain source and the gate voltage. And we can sort of make a fingerprint of this thing, which is a charging diamond versus gate and drain source. It's a superconducting electrometer. It's also made out of aluminum, so it's complicated. But there are many points here where you can bias the transistor and have it function as an electrometer. Essentially, anywhere that you can make a cut and see a strong modulation of the conductance as a function of the gate voltage, it also operates as an electrometer. And all the data I've shown you so far is taken right on the side of one of these peaks here, which we call the eye feature. Other people call it other things. There's not a standard name yet. And ask me a question, I'll talk a little bit more about what that process is. But basically, this is the lowest bias and the lowest total current through the electrometer where we still have a strong modulation and we can observe. So the first evidence that this anomaly in the ground state spectrum we see is due to the back action is provided by looking at how the Cooper pair charge depends on the bias conditions of the electrometer. So we can operate, as I said, at many different points in this gate drain plane. And here are several different curves taken at different bias positions. Basically, as we go up here the ladder, the average current increases somewhat. Here's the feature I showed you before, which consists of this long step, short step. If we go, for example, to the gap rise, where there's about 500 picoamps of current through the electrometer, we see something which is basically completely 1E periodic. It almost looks like the 400 millikelvin data. You're really strongly affecting the spectrum of this, the system you're trying to observe. We can talk a little bit more in detail about what the back action of the SET is due to. Remember, we have a current. We're using this as an RF SET, but that doesn't really matter. The RF bias is actually small compared to the DC in these measurements. So what's happening is there's current flowing drain to source in the electrometer. That current goes by means of discrete tunneling events through the junctions and in a Poisson random kind of way. So the charge state of the island of the electrometer fluctuates in a random way between two values, which are basically separated by E over C. So this is what the voltage on the island of the transistor looks like as a function of time. The spectral density of that looks something like this. It's a sort of a Lorentzian with a cutoff, which is related to the average rate at which tunneling events take place, I over E, the current through the electrometer. The effect of this fluctuating voltage on the electrometer's island is to induce, via some capacitive division by the box capacitance and the measurement capacitance, a fluctuating voltage which is smaller but still fluctuating on the Cooper pair box itself. Okay. So what is that going to do to your two-state system, to your qubit? Well, we can go back to this block sphere picture. The fluctuating voltage means that we have a fluctuating fictitious field here in the z direction. And we can decompose that into two components. Charlie, is this the expression you were looking for? Somewhere here? Anyway. So there's a longitudinal part of the fluctuating field and a transverse. And you know from your two-level physics that those affect things in different ways. The low-frequency fluctuations, which are longitudinal, cause fluctuations of the Larmor frequency and give you dephasing. But the thing I'm going to worry about here is a more gross effect of the back action. That's actually to cause transitions between excited and ground state. And those come from the transverse fluctuations in the fictitious field, which are resonant with the energy splitting, in other words, which are stationary in the rotating frame. So there's an expression that lets one calculate this transition rate due to the voltage spectrum on the box. What we now want to ask ourselves is this back action that we expect from the single electron transistor sufficient to cause a saturation of our two-level system under some range of parameters? And so again, imagine there's this two-level system. We're driving transitions between excited and ground state and competing against some relaxation. So we want to look at the balance between what I'm calling the mixing rate, following sort of the nomenclature that Gerd Schoen and coworkers have adopted, caused by the measurement due to the single electron transistor, and compare that to the relaxation rate that we expect for the Cooper pair box. And, well, there's some terms here, there's some couplings, there's some angles dealing with the projection to the transverse component, but basically you see that both of these go as a ratio, well, as some spectral densities measured at the Larmor frequency or at the resonant energy splitting between the two states. So here is a plot of the spectral densities as a function of frequency that we expect for our device. This is the relaxation rate is basically given by vacuum fluctuations. It's sort of the transition rate due to the vacuum fluctuations of the environment seen by the qubit. So that, once you get to high enough frequencies, rises linearly with frequency. The spectral density for these back actions in various different bias conditions is dropping as omega squared. And so if you actually look now as a function of the gate voltage, and we vary the energy separation between the two states of the Cooper pair box, we probe the ratio of these two spectral densities at some frequency in this kind of range. And in fact, I mean, our naive calculation is that, well, somewhere around 30-some gigahertz, these two spectral densities are equal, and the relaxation and the mixing rates are also equal. And so that's where you start to have the onset of saturation. So toward the degeneracy point, you see that the mixing rate greatly exceeds the relaxation rate, and we're just going to depolarize our system. Now, I have one final piece of data here that I want to show you, which helps confirm this picture. I guess I can't rule out that we have a somewhat reduced even on free energy difference, but I think we hadn't appreciated till we sat down to do the calculations that if you make a good two-level system and you do this naive thing, which is measure it continuously, it's just going to be very easy to saturate the system, okay? And so the final piece of thing of data that I can show you here is time-resolved data in which we actually observe this mixing of the charge states due to the back action of the measurement apparatus. So on the left here is the average number of Cooper pairs on the island, measured in the sort of steady state at varying points in gate charge. And so this is, again, that short step region, which I'm now saying is a saturation due to back action. Now what I can do is I can fix myself at a particular gate voltage, for example, this point A, where we appear to be able to observe the true ground state, even in steady state. And what I do is at time t equals 0, I turn on the measurement. So the single electron transistor is now off most of the time. And at time t equals 0, I turn on the measurement, and we record the charge state. This is still an ensemble measurement. We're repeating this turning on of the measurement many, many times, 1,000 times or so, to get this kind of a curve. You see here, there's basically no transient. If we go to this point B, which the system is basically half saturated, what we find is there's an initial transient here due to the rise time of the measurement, which is about 300 nanoseconds. And then there's a slower transient where the charge state of the box begins in what we would expect for the true ground state, and it evolves toward this steady state value, which is halfway to saturation. And the time scale for that, because it's half saturated, right, is basically equal to both the mixing rate and the relaxation rate. That's where the mixing and the relaxation are just balancing each other. And so this allows us to make an observation basically of the T1, the inelastic lifetime of the Cooper pair box, under this condition that we have basically a continuous measurement. So this is a relaxation rate, which is still kind of worst case, because it could be even better when the single electron transistor is off. If we go further to this point C, which is deep in the saturation regime, we no longer see a transient, and that's because here what happens is, again, this mixing rate gets so fast that we're not able to resolve it with our current electronics rise time. So that once the mixing rate is much, much bigger than the relaxation rate, you really saturate the system and you go toward this totally depolarized spin in a time scale which is shorter than a few hundred nanoseconds. So, okay, well, this is a start. We've been able to measure a T1 and a T2. I've shown you that the measurement is really important and very invasive, but this is not news. I mean, we always knew that the idea here was that the single electron transistor is a very good way to make a measurement. It's a very strong measurement which projects out your spin onto the z-axis. So it's clear that you don't want to have the measurement on while you're trying to get coherence. So this is sort of what's next for us. You want to do some sort of a scheme in which you're doing quantum control. We've not been able to actually observe Rabi oscillations yet. And what you want to do is, at the end of your coherent evolution, you want then to turn on the measurement and make a determination of what the final charge state was at that point. And I'll just say that this rather long lifetime that we're finding for the Cooper pair box is basically what limits the signal-to-noise ratio you'll be able to achieve in a single-shot measurement. And I guess I'm encouraged by this tens of microseconds number, because I think it means that we won't be that far away from doing a single-shot measurement in the future. One other thing, we'll talk more about decoherence maybe in questions and answers. We've always believed that you should really operate the Cooper pair box at this degeneracy point, where you see the energy bands to first order are insensitive in the offset charge, which means that you're much less sensitive to these charge offset fluctuations, if that's what's really limiting the coherence. But by looking at the T1 and the T2 as a function of this gate voltage, I think one can learn a lot about the various noise spectra that are presented to the box and about the back action of the single electron transistor. So I think I'm out of time. Let me just say one or two quick things. Let me thank the people who did the real work, especially Conrad Lehnert, who got in at the ground floor, set up the apparatus, and now has been taking this beautiful data. And I'll just put up my conclusions, and we'll wait to take questions. Thank you. That's right. So, well, all right. I'm glad somebody asked that as a question. But they tried the exact same geometry that we're looking at here using a slow electrometer, the squid box, they call it, okay, and failed to ever get, quote, good parity and be able to see the 2E staircase. What they were forced to do, and the way they explained this to me, is they went to a geometry where the box is actually a single electron transistor and the leads come out to large distances. And they explicitly added some normal metal resistive areas in very close proximity to the Cooper pair box, which they thought would serve as quasi-particle dumps, a place for out-of-equilibrium quasi-particles to relax down to a lower energy state. So I thought I understood that and that picture was right. I think I'm now coming to believe that what they were perhaps doing by adding these normal metal leads was introducing an extra channel for relaxation of the quantum states. In other words, if you could couple the box more strongly to the environment, give it a way to get rid of the photons more quickly, you would not be so prone to the saturation. So I have a feeling that people have actually been looking at these things and throwing away the high quality factor Cooper pair boxes and saying that they might be bad parity. That's the short step, yes.
In their earlier paper, and the new paper, was a similar picture, and this E plateau was a real hot number of electrons.
That's right. That was always in something which had no Josephson coupling, only one normal contact or these normal metal dumps nearby.
There is normal contact.
Well, I mean, when you make, so to see the 2E periodic staircase in the first instance, what they did is they actually made a normal superconductor junction. So the island was superconducting, but the lead was normal. And then you don't have these coherent states, you don't have the two-level physics, and there isn't a possibility of saturating things.
Why is that intermediate level so level? Why is not the average curving
off? Why is the transition to that saturation so sharp?
Why is
that so flat? Well, I mean, the harder you drive the system, so I was really surprised to hear you say that you sometimes see photon peaks which are oversaturated. I mean, how can you do worse by driving the system hard than make perfectly equal weights in both the excited state and the ground state? I guess the point is actually that when you look at these spectral densities, the ratio of these two spectral densities as you move to lower frequencies goes as the frequency cubed, because the relaxation rate is dropping and the back action is rising as omega squared. So
if you reduce the power, does it get curved?
If we reduce which power? So we think we're limited. The RF power is small. It's basically the shot noise of the tunneling current that is limiting. There's no way to get rid of that except to turn the measurement on and off.
Question, can you adopt the delta solution of just making a less invasive measurement? You could reduce your capacitance coupling.
Absolutely, yeah. So the yes, that's, well, if you know a way to make an adjustable capacitor.
Can we put another 2-meg underneath the whole thing?
Okay, sure. We haven't approached that yet. That's right. That would be something interesting to do. I think, actually, this points to two different directions you might want to go. One is to really say, let me make an even stronger coupling to the measurement apparatus, and then I'll get my biggest signal, and I can do my fastest time resolution and really go for the sort of pulsed measurements, pulsed control, and all that sort of stuff. And the other direction that might be interesting to pursue is to just reduce the coupling so that you can do a much simpler measurement, a sort of steady state thing where you can observe the ground state and do your CW spectroscopy in peace.
Is it correct that to mix some rays is just the same as Q1, but just not because of the environment, but just because of the
This is really, you know, a toy, but I think the basic idea holds up. What I should really be doing here is showing you spectral densities which are two-sided, not one-sided, and we should talk about a difference in rates to go up and rates to go down. And so this one, the vacuum fluctuations of the environment is strongly asymmetric. It only causes downward transitions. And an interesting question is, well, what does this back action do? Does it really cause transitions which are in both directions?
Yeah, but was a back action from an environment which is not in dynamic equilibrium? Is it because the solenoid is different? Physically, it's the same inelastic scattering rate, but just induced.
That's I think what I'm saying, yeah. So the rates should be probably pretty close to symmetric if the electrometer is way out of equilibrium. Well, this all assumes that we know what the relaxation and the mixing rates are due to, the coupling that they're due to, that it's just through this capacitive effect and it's due to voltage fluctuations. That's not at all clear yet, I would say. But nonetheless, this is. I now realize we had to have seen a short step if we were doing the experiment right. So, anyway.
Should I ask you what the I feature is?
Sure, if you want. That can sort of help explain why this black power spectrum has this interesting peak in it here. So the I spectrum, the I feature was called by the Tinkham group actually 3E. It arises at a point where you have the intersection of two Cooper pair resonant tunneling conditions, but with different parities. So this is a complicated tunneling process where you have resonant Cooper pair tunneling through one junction, followed by a quasi-particle tunneling through the, let's call it right junction, then resonant Cooper pair tunneling in the right junction, and the quasi-particle tunneling through the left junction, which brings you back to the original charge state, and you can repeat. So there's sort of a four-step cycle that repeats and gives you this sharp current feature here. So our little toy model is that you have basically this combination of resonant Cooper pair tunneling plus this Poisson distributed tunneling of the odd states, which gives you something like just a shot noise roll-off plus a finite line width oscillation here at the Josephson coupling energy for the electrometer. But this feature occurs at a couple of gigahertz, so it's not really so important because we don't get down to energy splittings that are on that order.
Okay, that's my secret.